This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. And coming up on Africa News Tonight, Cyclone Kenneth has passed the Indian Ocean archipelago nation of Comoros today and is heading to Mozambique and Tanzania. And the United Nations has evacuated about 325 migrants from a detention center in Tripoli, as fighting between rival governments and Libya has made conditions in the capital extremely hazardous. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story: a cyclone has passed the Indian Ocean archipelago nation of Comoros today, with high winds and heavy rains being felt, airports and schools closed for precautionary measures. In fact, the Comoros Islands have been on a cyclone alert since Tuesday, along with Madagascar, Mozambique, and Tanzania. Now we are getting reports of damages in most of the cities in Comoros. To brief us on Cyclone Kenneth, we have in studio VOA's Abdou Shakour, who happens to be from Comoros. Welcome to Africa News Tonight.
Thank you very much.
So what's the latest on Cyclone Kenneth, which is posing life-threatening risks to people living in the Indian Ocean Islands?
As far as I understand, coming here to the studio, we are told that Kenneth is on its path towards Mozambique and southern Tanzania. People have been moving away from Mozambique in the town of Pemba, Cabo Delgado, and Mtwara, and Lindi in southern Tanzania. So it's a reach there. But as you mentioned, the devastation happened last night on the Comoro Islands, specifically the main island, which is called Ngazija. The area which was expected to hit most was the northern part. But according to reports that I've been talking to, the whole island, which is about 250,000 people, have been affected. The President Azali just spoke and said three people are reported dead, but they can't reach different areas because trees have fallen down, roofs have gone away, houses have been destroyed.
Has anything like this happened in Comoros before?
As far as I know, as I remember, nothing of this magnitude has happened in the Comoro. Comoro is in between Madagascar and Mozambique. It has always been shielded. We get a lot of rain and wind or cyclone on one part of the island or some part of the island, but never seen the whole island being devastated by this hurricane.
So what is the government doing right now?
To tell you the truth, right now, the government has not taken, according to people I'm talking about, did not take any precautionary measures. We should understand it's been 2 weeks or 3 weeks. We had an election over there. Azali won. He doesn't have a government yet. So there isn't really a strong government to do anything to take care of actions or whatever is happening. Although the Minister of Interior has asked people to be calm, there is a Department of Emergency which is helping people. But what I understand is that Scouts and the Red Cross have gone village to village trying to help people, and people whose farms have been devastated. There's a lot of banana because it's the banana period, and breadfruit. People are taking those food which have fallen and sharing with others because they can't consume it in 1 day or 2 days. So there's that help between people themselves.
And when you mentioned the bananas, we have a celebration coming up in
Month of Ramadan is coming in a couple of weeks, and that's one big devastation for the people of Comoro, who are 99% Muslim. They're starting to talk how will Ramadan be, because it's a month where people eat in the evening and they depend mostly on the food they have in the farm, and now everything has been devastated. We don't know how it's going to be. Normally during Ramadan, food is very expensive, but now without all that they have been preparing for, because I can imagine everybody was farming and preparing themselves for Ramadan, but now they're faced with this important problem that there isn't anything left in most of the farms.
Now it has passed Comoros and is heading to Mozambique.
It's heading to Mozambique, and if you remember, it's 1 month after Idaia, which has created havoc in Beira, which is the center part of Mozambique. Now it's going to the northern part of Mozambique, which is Cabo Delgado, which is one of the poorest areas of Mozambique. People have been trying to get ready about it. International organizations are there. 600,000 people will be affected in that area. It's not known how it is. I read late before I came here, the meteorological department of Mozambique says that when it was over Indian Ocean, it was at category 3, and they fear it will hit land at category 4, which is a very strong storm.
VOA's Abdou Shakour, thank you for your current input.
Thank you very much for having me.
Tens of thousands of people participated in Sudan's capital today for what organizers called a million-strong march in support of civilian rule. The rally took place even though the ruling Transitional Military Council and opposition groups agreed to form a committee to resolve their disagreements. Naba Mohaddin reports from Khartoum.
Thousands of protesters responded to calls by the Sudanese Professionals Association to rally on Thursday in central Khartoum. Protesters flooded the streets leading to Sudan's army headquarters, calling for Sudan's Transitional Military Council to allow a swift return to civilian rule. SVA co-founder Mohamed Naji says they are demanding the military deliver power to the people. He says they called for a civilian presidential council, but with military representation, to fulfill the Sudanese revolution's demands. The SPA has urged all parties to nominate leaders for a civilian transitional council. The demonstrators were divided into groups of doctors, lawyers, journalists, bankers, and engineers. Protesters Muhammad Ahmed is with his doctors' committee. He says they will stay in the sit-in until the revolution's demands are fulfilled, and they won't go back to their homes before this happens. The protesters have been camped in front of army headquarters since April 6, refusing to disperse even after the military said last week it had ousted former President Omar al-Bashir. Sudan's military says it placed Bashir under house arrest, but reports on Wednesday quoted sources saying he had been moved to a federal prison. On Wednesday night, Sudan's military council said it had detained Bashir's brothers, Abdullah and Abbas, as part of efforts to remove symbols of what it called a corrupt regime. The military council announced also the dissolution of security forces loyal to Bashir, saying they would come under the authority of the army and police. Despite the reported arrests, protesters such as Maynou remain skeptical. She says they hear that Bashir is in jail, but they don't want him to be sent to another place. They want a public trial for all crimes he committed in Darfur, says Noor, for the genocide and killing protesters. The council on Monday gave Sudan 15 days to allow a civilian-led transitional government or face suspension in the African Union. Sudan's protests began in December, when fuel and food shortages led to price hike and calls for Bashir to step down, and then a military coup that removed him from 3 decades in power. Naba Mohaddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
4 months after Sudan's pro-democracy protests began, leading to the ouster of President Omar al-Bashir, demonstrations in Khartoum continue to press for rapid transition to civilian rule. And while every part of Sudanese society has taken part in the protests, young women have been especially visible. To find out why, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke to two female activists living in the U.S.
That's a young woman leading a pro-democracy chant outside Army headquarters in Khartoum, as recorded by VOA. Back in the U.S., Maureen O'Neill is a 25-year-old Sudanese mental health professional living in New York. She recently went back home to participate in the demonstrations, where she was struck by the youthfulness of the protesters, most of whom were between 18 and 30 years old.
And in that age range, we have more women than men, at least in the capital city, because a lot of the young men have traveled abroad because they're expected to be the breadwinners for the family. But a lot of single young women are still in Sudan, still with their families, and they're the ones participating in the ground.
Anil says women suffered most under Bashir's 30-year rule when his National Congress Party instituted the so-called public order law, which is still in effect. Rooted in Sharia law, it calls for flogging women for wearing trousers, for committing adultery, and for selling or consuming alcohol.
Also, the kind of professions that they target, such as selling tea and coffee in the street, that is something that is mostly done by women in Sudan. Also, selling homemade alcoholic beverages. These are the things that are targeted by the public order law. And it is important to note that it is also disproportionately women of ethnic minorities, or at least ethnic groups from the periphery and other groups that have been historically oppressed by the government and by the center.
That's why Tweba Eltome believes that for many women, this uprising is not only about changing the regime.
It's changing a lot of values that has been shaped around women, their shape and how they look and what they wear, and they are determined to changing how society perceives them.
Eltome wants to see a world where women's rights are human rights.
This revolution stands on three values, which is freedom, peace, and justice. And you can't talk about justice without considering the representation of women. So women now, the second wave of their uprising is to make sure that they are equally represented in any new shape of democracy, any new shape of government, as well as they were equally represented in this uprising.
The question is whether the power women are bringing to the uprising will translate into political power and equality if democracy is achieved. Maureen Alneil is not optimistic. She recalls Sudan's pro-democracy uprisings of 1964 and 1985, which were spearheaded by unions.
Two of the main unions that started or sparked those two revolutions are the Nurses Union and the Teachers Union. Both are majority women, but nobody remembered their role after the revolution. Nobody went back and said, you know, this demographic gave us so much, then they should be respected and honored for what they've done. It is easy to forget the role of women in a lot of historical events. It's not something that is exclusive to Sudan.
The situation in Khartoum remains both tense and fluid. The protesters have their ideals, while the military has the firepower. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
17 past the hour, you're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America. The United Nations has evacuated about 325 migrants from a detention center in Tripoli after reports some were attacked for protesting bad conditions. Fighting between rival governments in Libya has made conditions in and near the capital extremely hazardous. UN officials say they already are deeply concerned for the safety of about 3,000 migrants in detention centers in Tripoli. Thousands of migrants from the Middle East and Africa tried to make the dangerous journey to Europe across the Mediterranean Sea from Libya every year. Along with calling for an immediate ceasefire, UN officials said they urgently need more than $10 million to help civilians in Libya. The International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, today expressed concern for people in and around Tripoli, where thousands of people have been displaced. The ICRC said those remaining face difficulty getting health care. Forces loyal to General Khalifa Haftar is attacking Tripoli, and the internationally recognized administration of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj. Health workers at Ebola centers in the Democratic Republic of Congo are threatening to go strike next week if the government does not do more to protect them. Several health care centers have been attacked in the eastern DRC since the latest Ebola outbreak began nearly 9 months ago. The volatile region is home to several militia groups that do not trust the international aid effort to halt the virus. Many area residents also are unfamiliar with the virus and have accused healthcare workers of spreading it. More than 1,300 people have contracted Ebola in this outbreak, and nearly 900 have died. As the World Health Organization marks World Malaria Day today, Malawi has launched the pilot phase of Africa's first ever malaria vaccine. The WHO chose Malawi alongside Ghana and Kenya because of the high numbers of malaria cases and treatment facilities. The pilot phase aims to vaccinate 360,000 children per year, 120,000 of them in Malawi. But as Lamek Masina reports from Lilongwe, while the vaccine is expected to save thousands of lives, its effectiveness is limited.
Health officials at Malawi Silikuni Community Hospital are giving children injections of Africa's first malaria vaccine. The mosquito spread disease kills more than 430,000 people per year, most of them African children. It took over 30 years and nearly $1 billion to develop a vaccine against malaria. Known as RTSS, the vaccine is only helpful for children under 2 years of age who receive 4 doses at months 5, 6, 7, and 22. Michael Kayange is Malawi's deputy director of health.
After we did clinical trials, we had several age groups that we looked at. This vaccine was seen to be very, very effective in children aged between 5 months and 22 months. In other age groups, it didn't really show usefulness.
A long line of mothers brought their children to choose this launch of the pilot phase of the World Health Organization approved vaccine. Malawi's mothers, like Faneka Pantengo, are excited about the vaccine's potential. She says malaria is a deadly killer disease for not only children, but adults as well. Although she has other children who are not vaccinated, Kapantengo says she feels lucky to have her new baby protected from malaria. Testing between 2009 and 2014 showed the vaccine reduces clinical malaria cases by 40% and severe malaria cases by 30%, but it also caused a 60% reduction in severe malaria anemia, the most common reason children die from malaria. Kayange says Malawians will still need to take precautions to avoid their children getting ill from malaria.
So this new vaccine is just an additional tool to the control and elimination of malaria in this country. So whoever will get this vaccine, all the children that will get the vaccine, we encourage them to still use other malaria prevention methods, like sleeping under mosquito nets, getting to the hospital quickly when they have fevers or they have body aches.
Despite its partial protection from malaria, the vaccine could save millions of lives in Malawi, says Kayange. The pilot project will be launched in Ghana and Kenya next week. The WHO will use the results to inform policy advice before the vaccine is rolled out in other malaria-hit countries. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Lilongwe.
The Norwegian Refugee Council says hundreds of thousands of Cameroonians have fled their homes and lack access to aid or health services. The agency says the international community seems unaware of the humanitarian crisis in the English-speaking parts of Cameroon and urged new efforts to aid victims. Civilians have been caught in the fighting between Anglophone separatists and the central government, dominated by French speakers. Jan Egeland, the Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, says hundreds of villages have been burned and more than 500,000 people have been displaced since the conflict began 2 years ago. He said the agency is reaching out to both sides of the conflict, urging them to allow increased aid flows to civilians. The separatists say the government has marginalized English speakers for decades. The government of President Paul Biya considers the separatists to be terrorists. Domestic violence is a largely hidden problem in Zimbabwe. Some groups, however, are working to change attitudes towards something that traditionally has been considered private. Reporter Kudzai Zanawashi speaks with an activist working to end domestic violence.
Eunice Njovana is the chairperson of the Anti-Domestic Violence Council. She explains how her group acts as a watchdog and works to support victims.
To keep under constant review the problem of domestic violence in Zimbabwe, to take all steps necessary to disseminate information and increase public awareness on domestic violence issues. We are also to promote the establishment of safe houses for sheltering victims or survivors of domestic violence. Our vision is of a Zimbabwean society free from domestic violence.
She says women are most often the targets of domestic violence, but not always. Her group is still compiling statistics for 2018.
Just to give you a snapshot that in 2016, 1,993 men reported cases of domestic violence perpetrated against them, against 17,673 women that reported in the same year. In 2017, 2,461 men or males reported incidences of domestic violence perpetrated against them, against 16,067 cases of women and girls who reported domestic violence.
Giovanna says it is worrying that domestic violence harms vulnerable women in most cases. Domestic violence often happens partly because neighbors usually view such conflicts as private and believe they should not interfere or report the activities of other people. Giovanna says that needs to change.
The Anti-Domestic Violence Council is therefore calling upon communities to report suspected cases of domestic violence. And by the way, the Domestic Violence Act enables us to do third-party reporting. We all have an obligation to report.
She adds that the media and community leaders have a role to play in fighting domestic violence. Giovanna says communities should develop a zero tolerance towards abuse. Often, abused women in families are reluctant to report a case when the perpetrator is the head of the family. But the council says that, together with its partners, it has come up with interventions that empower victims economically when perpetrators are incarcerated. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zanawashi from Harare.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Cedric Franklin, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
This is James Butty, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05 and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
Hey! Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOAAfrica.com.
On VOAAfrica.com, the news updates never stop. Our primary goal is to keep you informed.
VOAAfrica.com, your trusted source for news and information.